You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Sorry. I didn't mean to intrude. It's been 2 days. Your son's not back yet? Who was that? On the video.
Hey. Good man. Like you.
Welcome, everyone, to the 602 Club, Trek FM's general geek show. I'm so excited to be back. It's great to be here with you. And I'm glad to be back with the apes. And I am very excited to welcome back to talk some Planet of the Apes with me, Brandon Chimitola. How's it going, Brandon?
I'm doing pretty darn good, and I'm happy to be here to talk more of one of my favorite franchises.
Awesome. Before we get started, Brandon, you were telling me that I've been in and out. I had a lot of things going on the past couple weeks. I was on vacation, and then I had a funeral to be at for my brother-in-law. So it's been a very busy few weeks, and I have not... I've not been able to keep up with things, but you were telling me that somebody came up with something to call ape fans there on Facebook.
Yeah, so we got at Trek FM here, we got a direct message or a private message, whatever you call it on Facebook, from Lori Damon Bose. I hope I'm saying that right. B-O-E-S-E, Bose. And this person said, what do you call fans of Planet of the Apes movies? Because we didn't know. We were trying to figure this out last time. We're like, what is the name of them? And this person said, obviously you call them apostles.
I like that, apostles. Apostles. That's awesome. Yes. Well done, Facebook. Well done. Oh, gosh. Well,
thanks, Lori.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really love that. If you want to connect with us, if you have ideas for things like that, when you hear us talking on the 602 Club or any of the shows, hit us up on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We've also got our listeners-only discussion group, the Babel Conference, and you can find that by typing Babel into the Facebook search field, or if you're on our website at trek.fm, you can hit discussion on any of the menu bars. It'll bring you over there, and you can talk with all the other listeners of the network about all the different shows. Of course, you can also find us on Twitter at Trek FM, and great places to check us out. And while you're at it, hit us up on iTunes over there at Apple Podcasts with a star rating and review. That really helps people find the show, and really appreciate everyone who's already done that for us. And we haven't had any in a while, so give us your review and we'll read it out on the show. I'm trying not to be scatterbrained, so I thought best place to start, Brandon, would be at the beginning, because this movie takes place 10 years later from the last one we saw, and the beginning of the film opens up with the credit montage of basically the globe, and it's kind of showing you how the virus is spreading and the decay and all of this. And I wanted to ask you how you thought that worked, is kind of opening this film and kind of setting us back up, especially maybe somebody had never seen Rise of the Planet of the Apes. How do you feel like this worked?
I think that you could have gone into this movie blind and not had to have seen Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I think it was a great way to open the film and recap what happened in the previous film for what you need going into this, because throughout the rest of the movie, all the other plot elements that you need from the first film are given to you like breadcrumbs throughout this movie. So everything else that you need about the simian flu and how it finished is given right in those opening credits. And I think it's great. It sets it up and says, this is why the apes are the way they are. And this is why there aren't very many people on the planet. Perfect. Perfect opening.
I think what you said is so perfect in the fact that this is a movie that people, you didn't have to see the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And how many franchises right now out there can you say that about?
Star Trek 2.
I think that's maybe one of the few. Of course, you also, I think, you know, Star Trek, it helps to have seen some Star Trek. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to me the way, you know, we talked about in the first review, the idea of franchises, how they created the first one. And I really think that the sequel does such a good job of, like you said, if you've never seen the first one, it completely sets you up for everything you need to know about what happened in the first one, while at the same time, just setting the stage for what's about to come. And I think that's really pretty awesome. The only thing I'll ding it on there is that they do use a couple of 21st century politicians.
Yeah, like Obama's in there.
I think that is a mistake. Not because of the politicians at all. This isn't a political thing. It's just that it dates the film. So I feel as though it would have been better served to maybe find people who are similar to those political characters that we have in our world today,
mm-hmm.
but not specifically do, you know, have Obama and de Blasio in the, or it's not de Blasio, it's their mayor previous, it's Bloomberg. In New York.
The only one I recognized was Obama because I'm from Canada.
Yeah. I just feel like it would have probably better served the movie in the long run. It's not a huge deal. It just is something that will kind of date the film in the end. Whereas, you know, you think about the original Planet of the Apes. Were there any specific dates in there about when they had left?
Yeah, I think they had said in there what year it was. It was like,
okay,
1973 or something like that. And I might be getting that year from Escape from the Planet of the Apes, but I'm pretty sure they had said what year it was when they left, because they're like, it's this many years later that they were asleep.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I mean that's fine. You know, I mean, you could do that. It seemed to me. This is something that you could have, they made that minor tweak and it wouldn't have been too bad. But obviously too, I mean, throughout the movie they use iPads and, you know, when the power comes back, oh, spoiler alert, and everything. So it was just something that I was thinking about, and I was on vacation and I was, watching the film with Nick Anastasio, and he actually said the same thing. As we're talking here, it's like, ooh, that kind of dates the movie. But I think it really does absolutely work so well to open the film and kind of just set the stage for the fact that, you know, in the 10 years that have passed, I mean, the world has absolutely just utterly fallen apart and has basically gone through another Dark Ages.
Yeah, it has. And I mean, like, the apes don't even know if they're still people. Like, in the opening scene, they say, we haven't seen them in 2 winters. And, you know, it sets you up.
10 winters.
No, 10 winters have happened, but they hadn't seen them in 2 winters. They hadn't seen any sign of humans in 2 winters. But it does set it up, and I guess it kind of does date it with the politicians. Because I noticed that, too, when I was watching it. I'm like, oh, hey, it's Obama. He's not president anymore, right? But I don't know. It didn't bother me too much, but I think it's interesting that they did a whole 10 years. Like, it doesn't have to be 10 years. And, you know, rewatching this film, the way that the city was degraded made me think a lot of I Am Legend while I was watching this, just the way that the cities were, like, you know, overrun with vegetation and whatnot. I don't know. That's just what I was thinking while I was watching it. But I don't know that it had to be 10 years later. So I don't know what's coming up in the next one. Like, it could have been 5. It could have been 4. I mean, it could have been, you know, who knows, right? Because these people would have died relatively quickly.
Right. I think they did 10 years because, honestly, that is a good way to have a city kind of begin to look like that, you know, where it really has degraded, where vegetation has taken over. Now, I will say, very funny, watching this film, I had spent a few days at that point in Northern California, in San Francisco, and San Francisco and Northern California don't look like that.
Well, they filmed it in BC.
Right. In the sense that, yes, that's my point I'm getting to, and I'm sorry I'm taking too long. No, is that, yeah, it looks like an evergreen rainforest, like far north Pacific Northwest, like Olympic National Park, or like in Vancouver, BC. And so it does not look like actual Northern California, except for in maybe the rainy season. But yes, this is a stretch of the imagination for it to look specifically like this. It looks beautiful. I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous. But that's not really what Northern California looks like.
Right, yeah. And that happens a lot in movies. I mean, you know, like X-Files was filmed up in Vancouver for how many years? And it, you know, Vancouver has been called Hollywood North because it's substituted for any location, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. Well, and of course, these days, you know, Atlanta has become the place to film, and so, and in fact, it's almost as big, if not bigger, I think now than actual Hollywood, with the amount of studios that are there. So it's just, it doesn't take away from the movie. It was just one of those moments where it was like, that's funny. I'm actually in Northern California as I'm watching this movie, and that's not what this looks like. But it's a fantastic way to start the movie nonetheless. And I think it just, as we said, it just really works. And so, I also thought, you know, this movie has that really interesting theme of the fear of what you don't understand. And that kind of starts right away with both sides, as, you know, the humans accidentally run into the apes. They're not expecting them to be there because they're on a mission. And one of them shoots one of the apes because it's so freaked out. And I thought that that was a really interesting thing to play with this movie, especially because it also builds on the fact that all of these apes have had really different experiences with human beings. And so what they understand as human being from human beings may not be quite the same as somebody like Caesar. And so there's this real battle that's happening on both sides from humans and apes that really is driving what becomes the conflict in the film. And I really liked that. I thought it was really smart.
The one thing that I didn't understand upon the second rewatch here that didn't quite work for me was how these people were all like, oh, they're just animals. How can they be talking? They don't talk. Like, it seems to me that after the simian flu and what would have happened, people would have seen intelligent and evolved apes. They would have known what happened on the bridge, right? Like, that was a big event that happened 10 years ago. It just didn't, it seemed an odd part of the storyline that they're like, oh, they're just monkeys or whatever. They shouldn't be talking to us. What are you talking about? That's not what you saw. You didn't see that.
Well, I mean,
especially after 10 years.
Right. But I think the thing is that they've been through 10 years of the Dark Ages. The internet doesn't exist anymore. I mean, the world is destroyed pretty much as we know it. I mean, you know, people have been dying out left and right. You know, the only people that are left are the people that are immune, have it genetic immunity. And that's why they've survived.
Right.
And so I think that that was kind of part of it, is that humanity is, it's trying to rebuild itself. Obviously, it doesn't seem like the apes have run into humans in a long time. Mm-hmm. And humans haven't run into them either. They're not even expecting them to be there. And so it almost feels like what happened 10 years ago is just become the legend of how everything started, than necessarily the belief that, you know, oh, intelligent apes, you know?
Yeah.
Especially after what happened in San Francisco, and that the spreading of the disease seems to happen very rapidly, it kind of makes sense that it's more like old wives' tales, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so when they run into talking apes, it really is a huge shock.
Yeah. I don't know. It just didn't see, it seemed odd to me. I understand what you're saying, for sure, like with no internet and stuff. But the impression that I got for the time frame in between and how the sickness, like in the recap at the beginning and how the sickness went and how long it took for the sickness to happen and all the news stories that were happening, it seems like they it just seems illogical to me that they wouldn't have realized that these apes were intelligent and, I don't know, you know, because they blamed the company. They knew what it was. They knew it was this Alzheimer's medication. So they knew what would have happened. They knew what happened on the bridge. So, I don't know. It just seemed a little... It doesn't destroy the movie for me. It doesn't take anything away. It's just one of the plot points that I don't
quite
like.
But I also think that has to do with... I mean, how many times have human beings wanted to demean something so that they didn't have to pay attention to it?
Once in a while.
I mean, we kind of do that a lot, you know? We treat something as different, so that we don't have to deal with it, or we dehumanize it, or we devalue it in a way that allows us to be able to do what we want with it. And I think that's kind of where some of the humans are coming from in this movie. Not all of them, but I also do think that that comes down to the idea of like the character Carter, the one who shoots Ash at the beginning of the film.
Right.
I mean, he's just a complete a-hole the whole movie. But he also brings up this whole thing about who to blame, right? Like, they have that conversation, and she, you know, you get Carrie Russell's character, Ellie, talking about, we know who to blame. It's us. It's not the apes. And he's like, oh, come on. Really? He wants to blame anybody but humans. And I mean, I think that was something that that explained to me why they're having such a hard time actually believing these are, you know, intelligent apes, because they don't want to, you know, they want to deny that that's the case, because it makes it easier to just want to kill them.
Right. Which that makes sense to me. I mean, you know, I believe Carver's point of view when he says, who else is there to blame? I'm going to blame the apes. And he wants to just close his mind off to the answers. We as the viewers and Carrie Russell's character, you know, like, they know the truth that it was because of this plague. But I mean, it's like 90% of the Facebook conversations you have where you're like, here's the answer. And they're like, I still don't believe it. Here's the proof. Well, I'm going to pick what I want to believe. Right. They're going to disregard the evidence in front of them and believe what they want to believe.
Right. Well, and I mean, in the end, too, I mean, it's easier than taking responsibility is just, or quote unquote, easier than taking responsibility is creating a scapegoat, you know, but I also think it's a scary thing because it, for humanity here, as we're looking at what's happened, are we going to learn from our mistakes? Or are we just going to continue to keep making the same mistakes? As these people try to reclaim what they've lost, are they going to continue just to go down a path that led to their destruction in the first place? And I think that's really the saddest part of the movie here, is because they're not actively dealing with the reality of what happened, they're not handling this situation very well, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's something that humanity is doomed to do, is repeat its mistakes over and over, right? I don't know. That's just my opinion. But I mean, like, you know, look at all the intolerance that we've got towards our own species right now, out in the world right now. I mean, it's just something that we seem to struggle with, is accepting differences and things like that. So, yeah, mistakes are going to be repeated over and over and over by humanity forever.
Right. Well, and I mean, even here, think about it. Like, Ellie is specifically telling us what happened, like what the facts of it are, what the history of it is. And, you know, Carver is denying that history and saying that's not really, that's silly. What are we going to blame ourselves? And that is the very essence of those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we're getting in humanity. I mean, you thought this Dark Ages was bad. The next one could be even worse. And in fact, we know from apes mythology, it will be a lot worse
right.
for humanity.
Right, right. We'll stop learning how to speak. It'll be terrible.
Yeah, I mean, we are going to come to a place where we're going to allow ourselves to basically almost de-evolve because of the choices that we make. And really, you know, those who to blame and fear what you don't understand, all of this stuff really combines together. And it just creates this interesting conundrum because, you know, both sides actually have that who's to blame thing, you know, because Koba likes to twist the truth about everything because of his experience that he's had with humans. And a lot of those apes had that experience. You know, they didn't have Caesar's experience of a loving, caring, wonderful, you know, almost parent to take care of them. You know, they got the torture and the awfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, that really does... It's just interesting to me that it's not something that's just on the human side. I like the way that the movie mirrors the humans and the apes together to show us how, in the end, we're really not all that different.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We're both animals at heart, I guess, right? Like, people are sometimes, like, at our basest instinct and our worst instinct, you know, we're animals at heart. You know, I've had conversations with people before, you know, about things like The Walking Dead and stuff and how people are portrayed in those movies of, you know, you get these groups of people, you'll have groups of good and groups of evil. And I've had conversations with people who think, no, people will pull together and people will pull together, people will develop community. And I think, no, I think that people in those situations will take advantage of each other. Because if you look at a situation like, you know, a fire or a riot or whatever, like people in those situations when authority is gone, they delve to the most animalistic behavior that they possibly can. You know, they do terrible things when riots happen and stuff like this because they're just going with the flow of the animal nature that's all around them. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's an interesting line in the movie as Koba is talking to Caesar's son, Bright Eyes. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, at the beginning, after their hunt that they've had, he had to run in with the bear and got really messed, you know, not really messed up, but he got pretty hurt. You know, he got really scratched by that bear. And Koba tells him, scars make you strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very true. But do the scars lead to the right lesson being learned? Do they lead to bitterness or do they lead to wisdom?
Depends on how you get the scars.
Exactly. But it also depends on your reaction to getting the scars, however you got them, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that whole idea of who to blame and fear of what you don't understand really gets wrapped up in that idea too, because humanity has these scars from what it did. The apes have these scars from what happened. And in a lot of ways, the easiest thing for both of them to do is just blame the other mm-hmm. instead of the parts where they can take responsibility and the parts that are specifically are the responsibility of the others. And can we realize that maybe killing each other isn't the best course?
Yeah, it's interesting because, like you say, the scars make you strong, like you said there, but it is dependent on how you get the scars. Because the way that Koba got his scars is very different from the way that Bright Eye got his scars. And Koba, they were inflicted on him, and you can't really learn anything from that when it's been inflicted on you. Where, you know, Bright Eyes can take it as a learning lesson for how to hunt, right, and how to protect himself. So, yeah.
Well, and I mean, I don't know if there's nothing you can learn. I think you can learn the value of forgiveness or you can learn the root of bitterness. You know what I'm saying? Like, and Koba is never able to forgive. Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody like Rocket, who was also an ape that had been used in experiments, mm-hmm. is able to forgive humanity and trust and follow in Caesar. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's something that it's a big part of the movie. And again, it's not something where it's just on the ape side. It's also on the human side. And we see different characters in those different positions. And I think that's a really smart idea because that's also something that, you know, Caesar sees is that we're not that different. Mm-hmm. And again, I love the way in which he and Malcolm mirror each other. But then you have like Koba and Carver mirroring each other. Like you have all these characters, ape and human, mirroring each other. And I think it makes for a really, really impactful movie when you see that, because mm-hmm. it's showing two different sides and how if we could just remember that we're not all that different, that's where we need to start.
Right. And then you've also got, you know, Gary Oldman's character of Dreyfus and how he reacts to the apes with him losing his two sons, and Kerry Russell's character yep. of Ellie losing her daughter and how she reacts to the apes as well. So even on the human side, you got different people reacting in different ways to their kids being, lost and families being lost.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you end up with this place where, you know, and I thought it was pretty beautiful. You know, Malcolm and Caesar can kind of see the bigger picture, but I think it's because what's driving them is so important to where they're both looking for a way to build better lives from their families, for the future, and find hope. You know, and I think that has given them the ability to stop, think, analyze in a way that other characters aren't. And to be willing to extend a hand over the aisle, you know, to bridge the divide between ape and human. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, you know, I mean, in the world we live in today, I thought that was pretty fantastic. That's the message we all need to hear, you know?
Mm-hmm. The forgiveness, the divide, the difference, right? I mean, like, as a Canadian, you know, I hear all the time about 9/11, and 9/11 didn't affect us in Canada the way that it did. At least it didn't affect me the way that it does the States. And, you know, I see all this stuff on Facebook all the time where it's like, remember, remember, but there's all these tragedies that happen all over the planet. Why is that the one that gets honored and remembered every year? And as a Canadian, I look at that and I don't see what you guys see when that happens. You know,
well, I think you're speaking specifically to the idea of experience, mm-hmm. you know, and so say what Koba experiences is completely different than what Caesar experiences. And that changes everything, you know, so that attack happens to the U.S., not to Canada.
Right.
You know, in the same way in which the attacks that have happened in Britain have had an impact on that culture, or in France, or, I mean, any of the other countries in the world that have experienced big terrorist attacks, mm-hmm. You know, they have their remembrances. Also, I think it was a pretty shocking event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not
well,
just
I'm not belittling not, the event.
No,
like, yeah,
no, absolutely. You know. But I mean, you know, I just think it's one of those things. Like, even if it didn't happen to you in your country, it was still a wake up call for the entire world of like, oh wow, this, you know, you can take down the World Trade Centers of the United mm-hmm. States. What else could happen?
Right. I mean, I remember where I was when I heard the news, and I was just like, the world is ending. Like when this, I was in Vancouver at the time visiting my dad. And when I was watching the news, I'm like, this is it. The world's done. Like what? I was so scared the day that happened. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, afterwards it's like, okay, it's an event that's happened and now it's over. And now, I mean, now I got to take my shoes off when I go through the airport security.
Well, and you also have to remember too, that for Americans and America, the way our country was founded and created, it's always kind of been through the fire, you know? And mm-hmm. and so we remember Independence Day. I mean, so
I love Will Smith in that movie. That's yeah, such you know, a great movie.
But that, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like that, and that happened, you know, 240 some odd years ago now. I think it was 243 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, we still remember that. So it's definitely a part of the American culture to do that. Mm-hmm. But I also think that's an important thing, right? And that's something we're kind of talking about here, about this whole idea of how we're not that different, who to blame, fear of what you don't understand, and the idea of what we talked about with history. Like, if you don't remember it, you're going to repeat it. And so we create these idea of remembrances so that we don't forget what happened, so that we hopefully don't repeat those mistakes again. And humanity, because I think of, especially in this movie, with what it's been through, this kind of dark ages, these ape ages that's starting, you know, it's really changing it's making it harder for that remembering to happen. And so, and what we're seeing is that these people are on the cusp of making maybe the same mistake that they did before, you know, and it wasn't against apes, but it was the way in which, you know, the world has been run, where people go to wars over, you know, things that don't have to go to war over. And that's what was so great about We're Not That Different. You know, Malcolm and Caesar can see that. It's so hard, though, because the rest of humanity and the apes are having a hard time seeing that. Mm-hmm. Until it's too late, you know? I mean, at the end of the movie, it's too late. As Caesar said, apes have started this war, and humans are not going to forgive. And I think that statement is huge, because that's also the same thing that happened with Koba. Koba was hurt by humans, and Koba was not going to, in the end, didn't really want to forgive. Mm-hmm. And he used this as an opportunity to start a war. So right. What I love is that it's like both sides are again, ultimately responsible for what's going on.
See, one of the parts of this movie that I find really interesting is right at the beginning, when Caesar first allows them to go to make the power, and Koba says to him, he says, "Why are you doing this? If you give them power, they're going to be strong again." And, you know, one of the things that I find interesting, I love post-apocalyptic movies like The Stand and things like this, because I like to see how people are going to react after a huge catastrophe.
Yeah.
And one of the common tropes that I like is, and I don't know why I like it, is that humanity is going to screw everything up and destroy it all because we're terrible people. Right. And it's a thing that you see a lot in science fiction. And this is an example of it as well. Humanity screwed everything up. They made this. They tried to make this cure for something. It turned into something completely different. Everybody's dead. Nobody's got power. There's like just a little few people left. So why would you give them the ability to rise up again? Why would the apes help them rise up again and become strong again? I kind of agree with Koba's point of view on that, especially in this, you know, this artificial timeline of humanity's destroyed the planet, right?
I think because, and this is the interesting thing, is, and something I didn't even, I've been thinking about, and I didn't really put on the outline, but the whole idea of this idea of morality being passed on. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting, because Caesar has had the morality that he has passed on to him from Will, from the first movie. And he even says, when he is talking to Malcolm at the old house, Malcolm asks him, "Who was that on the video?" And he says, "It was a good man." Mm-hmm. "Like you." And Koba doesn't understand that.
Right.
He doesn't have any idea of morality. what his morality is based on, that the strongest that might makes right. And Caesar admits that later on in the film, that for apes, they always choose the strongest branch, he says.
Yeah.
And so it's very much something that is an important in the film, because it does bring up this interesting question about, like, how do we know what the right thing to do is, and where do we get that from? And, you know, all of that stuff. And a big part of that is, you know, from what we learn from the people around us and those who teach us. And, you know, it's very interesting to watch Caesar try to pass that on to the other apes. And the struggle that he realizes again at the end, we're not that different.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that apes were better than men, but when I realize we're not that different, it makes me I need to be a better discerner of character, because just because you're an ape doesn't mean you're good.
Mm-hmm.
And just because you're a man doesn't make you bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really fascinating. You know, again, when we're talking about messages we need to hear, just because somebody's quote unquote on our side doesn't make them a good person, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, how we discern who's good and who's bad and who's right and who's wrong is there's a lot more nuance to it. And therefore, what's the standard that we come to? And, you know, for Caesar, who's good is what he learned from who Will was. But I think what's interesting is that Will was somebody who seemed to be somebody who was pretty sacrificial and willing to do everything he could to save the life of his father, so family, protecting family, and protecting others. And, you know, that's a pretty decent basis for morality.
Mm-hmm. I just want to go on a quick tangent here and just say I love James Franco in this movie, and I think he did just as good a job as he did in Alien Covenant in this movie.
It's funny because he really makes money on films that he's not even in.
I wonder if he got it much for this, like using his image and stuff. I wonder how that works.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they have to.
Because yeah, Alien Covenant, he filmed those deleted scenes. Like, there was that trailer that was out. Like, he did some filming. But
yeah, I'm sure that he gets paid something for that. So, I mean, it's Hollywood. You don't get paid for nothing. And so,
like, I think I need to watch this movie some more, because I've only seen it twice. And, I mean, like, I'm wholeheartedly on the ape side in this. Maybe it's because of my love of the ape movies. But, like, I don't know if I'm messed up or not or what. Like, I don't know what side you're on when you're watching this movie. But I'm, like, I'm just completely siding with the apes when I'm watching this movie. Like, I don't know. What about you?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I think I'm not on anybody's side, except for I'm on Malcolm's side and I'm on Caesar's side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm on the side of the people who are right in this movie. And I think that's what's so interesting is there's a clear delineation between those who are right in the movie and those who are wrong in the movie.
Yeah.
And the people who get it and the people who don't. And it's the people who don't that are going to cause the entire world to explode again. You know, they're just making it worse. And there are these two people who still are holding on to ideals beyond just survival of the fittest. You know? I mean, that's where we... And that isn't a really interesting thing, because this desperation that's happening... Even with a character like Gary Oldman, and of course you've got Koba on the other side, they allow that desperation to bring out the worst and the basest of instincts, which is, again, just survival of the fittest.
Right, but there's a big difference, I think, with Koba and with Gary Oldman. See, Gary Oldman, Koba was great. Okay, so let's see if I can put this into a cohesive thought process here. Koba was fantastic, like a wonderful character, portrayed well, acted well, special effects looked awesome. But in the end, he's just turned into this angry villain. And Gary Oldman's character is reacting because he doesn't quite understand what's going on. So, you know, they just want to create this power. They don't know what's going on. The apes come and threaten them, right? They say, don't come to our area. And then all of a sudden, yeah, he's working on these weapons and stuff, and he's building up this stockpile of weapons. But, you know, according to him, then he doesn't understand what's going on when all of a sudden they're attacked by all these apes and he's just protecting his home. So when Koba, at the end, he's just like, he's turned into one of those maniacal villains where he's imprisoning his own people because they won't follow him. He's killing people left and right because they won't follow him. They're completely different levels of characters, I think, you know, like.
No, I mean, I see what you're saying, but at the same time, Gary Oldman's character is not that far from being Koba, mm-hmm. I don't think. I think that he would rather wipe out the apes. And in the end...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But in the end, that's exactly who he is. He's the same exact character because he's going to bring down the tower to try and kill all the apes instead of allowing them the time, Caesar the time, to try and make things right. And they've already called the army in, too. So,
but that's just it. They don't know.
Right. I understand what you're saying, but what I'm saying is that that's his first instinct. His mm-hmm. first reaction is the same reaction that Koba has, which is we just go to war. Because we don't understand what's happening, so we just go to war. Like, that's the basest instinct. Mm-hmm. Instead of trying to be more human and understand really what the situation is and what's going on. We obviously know the situation is much more complicated, right, than we first knew.
Yeah.
Like, these apes are much smarter, right? Everything is not what we thought it was. And yet, again, his first reaction is, no, we call everybody to war. And I understand, obviously, Koba makes the decision to attack. And, of course, at that point, humanity is trying to defend itself.
Yeah.
So, again, it's not as clear-cut. There's a lot of gray in the movie, and I think that's what makes it really fascinating. But there's also a good way to handle things, and there's a bad way. And I don't think Gary Oldman's character actually handles things the right way in the first place. Because I feel like the whole time, he has a really itchy trigger finger. He'd rather just destroy them. Mm-hmm. In the same way that Carver would rather just destroy them. He's just a little bit more diplomatic around Malcolm with it. I don't know. I don't know if that helps at all, or if it's just. But I think that's what's interesting to me in the movie is this whole discussion that we're having, because it's not all just clear cut, right? And I think that makes for a much more fascinating movie than just being like, oh, well, these were the good guys and these were the bad guys, you know, like. What it kind of reminded me of is that idea that we have you seen Wonder Woman, Brandon?
No.
Okay. There's a point in Wonder Woman where Steve Trevor says, "Well, maybe we're all to blame. Maybe it's you know, maybe we don't deserve good things. Basically, maybe we don't deserve your protection, Wonder Woman." Maybe it's not about who's like every, you know, there being good guys and bad guys, or one bad guy we punish, and maybe we're all to blame. And I think that this movie is one of those things, like, as we've been talking about, it is, we all have some culpability in the end, at this point, 10 years later, mm-hmm. for everything that's going on. So what did you think? I wanted to ask you, before we get too far from being able to actually get it in, we had a couple of new characters. I wondered what you thought about Jason Clarke as Malcolm. We had Kerry Russell as Ellie. And honestly, I think the other main impactive character is Kirk as Vado, I think is how he would say his name. Acevedo, excuse me.
Acevedo.
And as Carver. And I think those are the three main characters that are really super important in the film. That are new. What did you think about what they did?
I like Jason Clarke as an actor, I mean, every time I see him, I've enjoyed what he's in. You know, I love Terminator Genesis. I think it's a fun movie. I know that you didn't like it too much, but I love Terminator Genesis. And
no,
he was in a show.
Movie, Brandon. That's an awful movie.
I'm gonna just say that I think that Terminator Genesis was a better new sequel than The Force Awakens was. I also saw.
Well, Brandon, you can be found at Brandon Matullah on Twitter. So send your hate mail there, folks.
I also think that he was great in Brotherhood. It was a TV show that he was on with the guy that's going to be the captain of the Star Trek Discovery.
Jason Isaacs?
Jason Isaacs was in it as well.
Okay.
I think, right. I don't know, unless I'm really. It's really late at night, but I'm pretty sure those were the two stars that were in it. And it was a 3-season Showtime show that was really good. It was like their answer to The Sopranos, but with Irish people instead of Italians. So, but he was in that. It was good. So I don't know. I've liked him, everything that he's been in. I think it's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that he was wonderful in this movie. You know, I felt like him kind of being the forefront of the human characters and being this person who seems to be very thoughtful about what he's doing. He's a good, constructive, critical thinker. You know, he's willing to assess a situation fully before making a decision, which I think is what makes for a good leader. And he portrayed that perfectly. And so I think he did a great job. I mean, Gary Oldman, man, the guy is good in everything he's in. I mean, what isn't Gary Oldman good in?
Should be anybody? Gary Goldman.
Yeah, seriously. You know, Carrie Russell is great. She doesn't have a ton to do in the movie, but I think she adds weight to that character without her having to have a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, her best scene, I think, is when the baby ape starts crawling on her. That was great. I love that scene. Mm-hmm. And I thought she played that really well. And then Carver, I mean, the guy is just such a D-bag the whole time and just such a jerk. He even says, oh, I'm the a-hole. And I'm watching it with Nick Anastasio, and he's like, yep, yes, you are.
Yes, he's been good. What was he in? Was he in, he was either in Oz? I think he was in Oz on HBO. So, and, you know, like, again, these are great actors that they've chosen for these roles. Like, Kerry Russell was good for this role, and Kirk Acevedo, I think, was really good for Carver. But, yeah, he's also that character that's there to drive the plot and cause the problems, right?
Right, you know? Yes.
So, that's kind of what he's there for.
Well, and he does such a good job at it. I mean, like, you really do hate this guy. Mm-hmm. And by the time that Koba kills him, you really don't feel bad for him whatsoever, you know, because he has caused such an uproar for humanity. And you know, I know that Caesar says that, you know, we started this war, but Carver just shooting an ape for no good reason, just because he happened to come upon one, is kind of the impetus for everything else that happens, you know? So it's not a clear cut thing. I don't think of who started what. It's just a continuation of events that just gets away from both sides.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and there aren't enough clear heads, and it makes sense for what humanity has been through for 10 years and what the apes have been through and creating their society for 10 years. You know, you can understand why both would be on edge of trying to protect what they've created or what they've been able to get. And, you know, when you get the sense of when, you know, Jason Clark's Malcolm is talking to Ellie about why he can't go back to where they were because he can't let his son see those things again. I thought that was really strong. You know, the motivation for the characters, really well done. So, what did you think in this movie? Because obviously we talked about the last one, the music effects and the rest of the film. How did you feel? Because Michael Giacchino does the music here. Did you like the score?
I did. And I got to say, I didn't realize it was Michael Giacchino. I thought it was interesting because it was a pretty subdued score. You know, it was pretty calm most of the time, and like not relaxing, but like, you know, not atmospheric. I'm not quite sure the word I'm looking for. I mean, it was very restrained, I felt, which was neat. It was an interesting choice. So I did enjoy it a lot, and I'm surprised that it's Giacchino, but I liked it a lot. Because I normally am not a big fan of Giacchino, but it didn't really sound like Giacchino to me. I mean, Giacchino to me is that lost sound, which you hear in that, you hear it a lot, that lost music sound in the Star Trek 2009 movie, you know? You hear quite a bit of it. So this sounded very different to me from a Giacchino score.
Yeah, I've always liked him as a composer, and I think he did well here. I think it actually helped to have kind of a more subdued score. It had some really beautiful melodies in there with the apes, you know, at the beginning, their hunt, some of those things. The swell at the end, you know, of the movie was really beautiful. And I feel like he did a good job. And so the thing that really stuck out to me is, and we talked about here last time, we were talking about Rise, was the fact that the effects there were so good. Here, I would say they're almost flawless most of the time.
The bear attack scene didn't work for me too well right at the beginning, but I would otherwise, yeah, it was pretty darn good. Yeah, I mean, that was the only one that really pulled me up. Right, and it's right at the beginning, so I'm like, oh man, like this is not looking very good right now. But then it definitely got better throughout the rest of the movie for sure. Some of those scenes, like Koba was flawless. Like there was a couple of times where I'm looking at Caesar and I'm like, he looks a little CG, and his son looked a little CG to me. But I mean, like they looked fantastic, but Koba was outstanding the whole time, I think.
And I will absolutely agree with you 100%. The hunting scene at the very beginning is a little sketchy. CGI wise,
but it's a hard scene to do.
Yeah, it is absolutely a hard scene to do. You have so many apes that are a part of that scene, and you have so many elk that you're trying to CGI, and you're trying to put all that together and everything. But and there were a couple other scenes where I was like, okay, that's definitely just a bunch of, you know, live action effects and CG effects all put together, but there were other scenes where a human being is talking to an ape in the scene, and you completely buy that both of them are real in it. You don't even think, you know, you don't even think, oh, that's CGI. No, you just think, oh, that's another character in the movie. Like Weta took digital character creation to a completely new level in this film. And it was outstanding, and it's exactly what you need for this movie to make it work. And I give them all the credit in the world for what they were able to accomplish, because honestly, I've seen this movie twice in the last few days now, and I was astounded each time how good those digital characters are. It's just phenomenal.
Were any of the apes real? Like, was there any shots at all that used real apes? Because Maurice is another one. Like, Maurice is flawless to me. Now, he never spoke, right? So he did sign language and stuff?
But he only does a couple of times, and it's very, I mean, it's not, I mean, it's just, it's very quick. You know, he doesn't speak a lot, so.
So was he entirely CGI?
As far as I know, he is.
Holy smokes,
I mean,
that's crazy.
I don't think any of the characters are not. So yeah, I'm right there with you. Maurice is another character when he's sitting next to Alexander, Malcolm's son, and they're reading. You can't tell which one is which. And so it absolutely just fantastic work here. So
yeah.
I can't think of anything else. I mean, we could obviously go on and on about this movie, and I love the discussion that we had, Brandon, about the complexity of the film. I think it's really, really cool. What would you rate this one, do you think? Because well, I remember, and this is be interesting, because I remember last time, let's remind everyone, you I think you said even on the show, and if it wasn't, you had mentioned to me after that you didn't remember mm-hmm. really liking this one. So yeah. I'm really interested to see where you come down.
First time I saw this movie, I've only seen it twice. I hated this movie the first time I saw it. I hated this movie as much as I hated Into Darkness the first time I saw it. I was livid and I did not want to ever watch this movie again. And the reason why I didn't want to, like, I was pulled out of a couple of things in the movie, and they're minor things, and I'm really upset with myself now. Like, there's two instances of bad language in this movie. Now, I watch a lot of violent stuff. I don't have a problem with bad language, but this is something that I'm struggling as well with the new coming Star Trek series, is how are they going to portray it on screen? The violence level in this was higher than any previous 8 movies, and there's swearing in it. Basically, every previous 8 movie has been PG. This one's PG-13, but that it took me out of it because the Apes movies, to me, are family movies, and you can take your young kids to it, and they're saying a-hole and effing and, you know, things like this. And while it doesn't, those words don't bother me. I can hear them in movies, and it doesn't bother me. It really took me out to hear them in an ape movie. And then especially the scenes, like there's like the scene when Koba goes back the second time to those two guys testing the guns, and he's like playing all clownish and whatnot, and he grabs that machine gun and just blows them away. Like, that really bothered me because that's like another level of an Apes movie, right? Like, that's way beyond anything we've seen in a Planet of the Apes movie this far. So I walked out of the theater like this was the worst thing ever. But this time I watched it and I really, really loved it. I really, like, completely 180 degrees turned my opinion around on this. And I don't know why I've had such a drastic change, because, again, I've only seen it twice. But, you know, I think I gave the last one 4.5 out of 5, and I think I got to give this one the same thing, 4.5 out of 5. Like, I think it's a phenomenal movie, and I'm interested to see how I'm going to react when the new Star Trek series comes out, because it's going to be different than any Star Trek we've ever seen before.
I absolutely agree. I think that's a really, it's a really, anytime you're adding to the franchise you already love, there's a danger in that. So I'm right there with you. You know, I am going to be very interested to see what Discovery is like. And I would say my excitement level is somewhere, there's not really excitement. There's not hate. It's just kind of like, well, let's see what you got, you know, and you're really going to have, like, you have your work cut out for you. You know, I'm not going in super excited. I'm not going in super like, eh, you know, it's just like, well, let's see what you got. With this one, though, I remember liking this movie better than the first one. And then it was confirmed. This movie is phenomenal. It's just so, so, so good. I would say that this is, when it comes to what this movie is trying to do and the kind of movie this is, it's almost perfect. Like, there's almost nothing wrong with this film. And so for me, this is 4.5 out of 5 spilled bottles of Johnny Walker Blue Label, which I couldn't believe those guys were drinking Johnny Walker Blue Label. And then it gets just wasted. Oh, man. They wasted on an ape. Come on, guys. But this is a fantastic movie, and like you, this leaves me at a place where I'm almost like, oh man, oh please let war be good. Please let war be good.
Well, from everything I've heard, it's gonna be great. So
yeah, I mean I'm hearing the same things too, and so it's just like I really do want it to continue to, you know, this series and close it out well. And so really fun getting to walk through this with you, Brandon, and I can't wait talking about War for the Planet of the Apes with you. But before we go, make sure you check us out all over the places that we mentioned there at the top of the show. Really want to thank our associate producers here on the 602 Club. We've got Ken Tripp and Tavis Grayson. They've been supporting this show through Patreon for a very long time, and Patreon is the place that's so important to us here at Trek FM, because this is a huge network. We have so many shows coming out. We're already planning our Discovery shows as well. We love doing podcasts for you, but it's an expensive enterprise to put this out. There's just so much going on, and there's no way we can do it on our own. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm. See how you can be part of our team. We've got amazing perks for you. Brandon runs our Patreon's exclusive group. It's fantastic. There's so much that we love giving back to you. So make sure that you check it out. Every little bit helps. So again, that's patreon.com/trekfm. Brandon, before we get out of here, let everybody know where they can find you if they'd like to talk about apes or maybe just how they really disagree with you about The Force Awakens.
Terminator Genisys is awesome. You find me hosting my Terminator Genisys podcast over on the Terminator Genisys Network. You can also find me with 3 more episodes of Melodic Treks. We're wrapping up Melodic Treks soon. So we have a great interview coming up next, plus a couple of cool episodes. Episode 83, I've got a great interview with a guy who's creating a documentary on how they make soundtrack releases. And then episode 84 is going to be a music all about Star Trek Voyager music, an episode all about Star Trek Voyager music. You can find me on Twitter, at Brandon Metella. You can find me every once in a while on the Facebook group as well, poking my head up. But my other two podcasts, one's here on the network with my buddy Floyd. It's called Warp 5, and it's all about Star Trek Enterprise. And then over on the Fandom Podcast Network, I have a show called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast that I host with my friends Tom Caldwell and Chris Haig. And we're going through the Hitchcock films one at a time. And the episode this month is actually going to be another composer interview with Chris Bacon, who composed all the music for Bates Motel. So there's some fun stuff going on over there.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones talking about Deep Space Nine. If you want to listen to how wrong Brandon is on the 602 Club about Terminator Genisys, you can find that on episode 38, Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey Terminator. You can find me on the Nerd Party Network where I'm talking about Harry Potter, walking through each and every chapter of the book series with Drea Kaufman on Owl Post. You can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills talking about Star Wars. We have a blast over there. We also have a very special episode coming out soon about our trip to Lucasfilm and Skywalker Ranch, so make sure you check that out. And I'm doing one more podcast, and that's called Cinema Stories, and that is all about film through the lens of faith. So I hope you check all those out. You can find on any podcatcher or, of course, on Apple Podcasts. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear? Get your cannonball. Get back.